This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. A quick note here as we begin the program. We are expecting a news conference from the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in regards to some comments with the situation developing in Syria. As those comments come from the Secretary of State, John Kerry, we will bring those to you live here on WLRN. On the Florida Roundup this week, the good news for homeowners, fewer of you owe more on your mortgage than your home is worth compared to a year ago. The bad news, though, one out of three owners with a mortgage still are underwater. That news came this week from real estate firm Zillow. Now, rising prices means fewer homeowners are stuck in homes where they owe the bank more than a buyer is willing to buy the home for today. Now, for 18 straight months, South Florida home prices have been rising. One reason is cash. For every 10 homes sold in July in our region, 7 were bought with cash. No mortgage, no credit check, no bank. Cash.
The Benjamins. We consider the real estate field the last frontier of money laundering. You pick up any legal newspaper any given day of the week, and you'll see major real estate transactions being conducted on behalf of a company that ends with an NV, which means it's from the Netherlands Antilles, or a company, an LLC, out of Hong Kong or Panama or some other secrecy or tax haven. The laws are one thing, but the practicalities are another.
That's former U.S. prosecutor Charles Entriago. He now heads up the Miami-based Association of Certified Financial Crime Specialists, training officials to spot money laundering. So is South Florida's real estate recovery all fueled by dirty money? Brian Bandel writes about it in this week's South Florida Business Journal. He joins us here on the Florida Roundup, as does Billy Corbin, the producer and owner of Raconteur Films. So Brian, first of all, what evidence is there that we have that dirty money is being laundered throughout South Florida real estate?
Well, you have to look at the actions of the government, for one. The government has moved to seize 77 properties in criminal forfeitures in Miami-Dade County so far this year. That's more than the 59 all of last year. You can look at some of these cases. Alvaro Lopez Tardon, a Spanish citizen involved in what they allege is the Los Miami drug gang. He was laundering cocaine from South America to Europe. He bought 14 condos in Miami during the last boom from 2001 to 2006, including units in the Related Groups One Miami and in the Mark on Brickell. He owned the penthouse unit in the Continuum on South Beach. The feds allege that all that was bought with cocaine money. In some cases, he had a straw buyer buying it for him and later transferring it to him. Some cases, he bought it through an LLC. And the problem is they really haven't changed the rules with regards to LLCs to spot this kind of activity if you don't use a bank.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about the use of limited liability corporations. Billy Corbin, your film Cocaine Cowboys depicted really some of the illicit drug trade, obviously, in the 70s and 80s that fueled some of the real estate boom in the 1980s. What are similarities that you see?
Well, you know, they say the great thing about Miami is it's so close to the United States. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing now. Upwards of 73% of these transactions occurring in cash. You've got 90% of the buyers are foreign. And what we saw in the early 1980s was our number one industry, legitimate industry anyway, was tourism, generating in the area of $8 billion a year. During the same time period, the drug industry was bringing in $10 billion a year. And appropriately, during the Reagan era, it was really a microcosm of trickle-down economics, because that money found its way into literally every facet of our society here right. In Miami. Whether you were legitimately in the drug trade or you were just a car dealer or a jeweler, that money found its way everywhere, particularly to real estate and the development of this community. And I think that's what we're seeing now. Shockingly, 30 years later, we were really on the forefront of the financial disclosure forms, the idea that $10,000 cash suddenly put up red flags and everybody in the country, every federal agency was looking at you. Now you've got 30 years later, these wire transfers, which are not currency, but they're actually not being monitored in any meaningful way.
Brian, talk to about the practicalities of buying with cash, because we're not talking about suitcases full of $100 bills showing up at an attorney's office to sign the deed over when you're talking about buying these condominiums on Miami Beach and elsewhere.
Right. There are a number of ways they're trying to get away with money laundering. One way is a wire transfer from one bank to another. Often it can be from a foreign bank, because remember, foreign banks don't have the same know-your-customer rules United States banks have. If I go into a bank with $2 million and open an account, they're going to say, hey, Brian, where did you get all this money? What makes you so wealthy? You do that in some of these offshore banks, they don't ask you those questions. Now, the OFAC list, which is a list of terrorists and unwelcome nations like Cuba and Iran, they will check wires for that. But if you're a criminal, you get somebody else to be the head of the LLC, or you simply disguise who the head is, and then they might check the OFAC list. It might look clean, and they won't never know you're involved.
Billy, is this a situation again of almost a financial don't ask, don't tell, similar to what we saw back in the 1980s? If it smells like it, it looks like it, it probably is. But if there's no paper trail, it's all clean.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, where there's smoke, there's fire. And as Peter Zalewski of Condo Vultures once told me, you know, we set the fires down here and up in Washington and Wall Street. They're trying to read the smoke signals of what it is that we're doing. The Florida of today is the America of the future. And the truth of the matter is that we've always subsisted in this town with the next hustle, basically. And that's exactly what this is. I mean, we did such a great job regulating the mortgage industry. In the state of Florida alone, we licensed thousands of convicted felons because we don't want to know where the money's coming from. The money is propping up this economy, so it does no one any good to ask tough questions.
That's Billy Corbin. He is the producer and owner of Raconteur Films, perhaps best known for the documentary film Cocaine Cowboys about the drug trade and the significant impact of the Florida economy back in the 70s and 80s.
The Federal Reserve Bank in Miami generated a surplus of $5 billion, more money than all of the other Federal Reserve combined.
Miami was the most dangerous place on earth.
They called them the Cocaine Cowboys.
Cocaine Cowboys.
That was back in the 70s and 80s as the drug trade was fueling Miami real estate in the big boom that we had in the 1980s locally. Brokers, real estate agents, let us know what you're seeing. You're on the front lines of this. Have you done deals where there's lots of cash that seem to come from questionable places, perhaps that nobody's asking the right questions at the right time? Is it easy to spot dirty money? Brian, how about it? What do the regulators say? Is this a matter of identifying this early in the transaction?
Well, there are a number of ways that can be identified. Part of the problem is that real estate agents and closing agents don't have to file suspicious activity reports like bankers and mortgage brokers do. But if you're involved in a transaction, some of the things you may want to look for: does the buyer bid more than the asking price of the property? Without really trying to negotiate. Is they're not trying to negotiate it down? Because with money laundering, you want to put as much money through as possible. You don't care if you overpay. Are they buying it without looking at it, without doing an appraisal, without doing an inspection, without caring about the features? I hear a lot of people who, the real estate agent calls and says, I have a client from South America, they're buying it, they don't even want to tour it. So that's another way where something seems wrong.
Does the seller, Billy, does the seller have any responsibility in this to question the veracity and the validity of the buyer?
Well, currently, you could back me up on this, Brian. It seems that also the sale prices are somewhat disconnected from the reality of the market. This could be in part locals taking advantage of foreign buyers, but it also could very well be the fact that these buyers don't care what the price is, because they're attempting to get as much money clean as possible, and the sellers just don't care. The truth is, if a real estate seller had to fill out a suspicious activity report every time some suspicious activity occurred, they'd spend all of their time 24 hours a day doing it. I think everybody in Miami would.
Well, I'm sure we'll get some real estate agents and some closing agents that will say,
listen, on the 836 Expressway alone, I would fill out a suspicious activity report every 10 feet.
That's Billy Corbin. Yeah. That's more about our transportation and our driving habits from Raconteur Films. Brian Bandel from South Florida Business Journal. I'm Tom Hudson here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN, talking about the possibility of Miami real estate being fueled by money laundering here in the latest rebound. Give us a call at 1-800-743-9576. Online at WLRN.org and at Twitter at WLRN. Ken joins us here on the Florida Roundup from Lighthouse Point. Ken?
Nationally, the increasing real estate bubble is being attributed to hedge funds swooping into markets and buying properties, in many cases, by the thousands. I heard no mention of that in your report, and I have to believe, even if in this corrupt place like South Florida, bad money is fueling the bubble, to what extent could it be hedge funds? Please address it, because you're not.
Okay. Absolutely. Okay. Now, the study I'm talking about, it's only condominiums. Those hedge funds are buying mostly single-family homes. That's what you're seeing there. A lot of the condo sales, 90% are foreign. Most of the hedge funds doing this are based in the United States. They're not foreign. And the other factor is the new buildings. According to Condo Vultures, 152 condo towers planned in South Florida, the majority of them in Miami. The average asking price, $725 per square foot. 16 buildings are asking more than $1,000 per square foot. That is not hedge funds. Those are mostly international buyers. Who knows exactly who those buyers are? Some legitimate, some may not.
But is the implication that the sellers of this real estate, which another feature of the South Florida real estate market is very tight inventories. There's not a lot of properties for sale. I want to say it's around 4 or 5 months of inventories based upon the current pace, which is roughly half of what it normally is. So is there an implication as you go through those statistics, Brian, that somehow the builders, the developers, the sellers are complicit?
Well, I think they're trying to take advantage of an opportunity. They see one building pop up, they see it sell out quickly, and they're like, oh, I'll do the same thing. I'll put this building up. I put one building, it's good, I'll put another. They're trying to plan as many as they can.
That's the way the market works, right? When there seems to be greater demand, Billy, you're going to have supply move into that market.
And we live in a peninsula. There is a finite amount of space and a finite amount of waterfront space. Everybody wants to be closer to the coast. No one wants to live inland. That's the great dream, is to live, you know, is to have a water view. And truth be told, every time we rebound, the real estate market, especially in Miami and in Florida, it rebounds bigger and better than it was before. The short-term threat, though, is with a bubble like this, because I don't think it's a legitimate boom. It's a bubble, that it will burst quickly and more ugly and be more damaging in the short term.
So we're using the term bubble as if everybody acknowledges that prices are higher than they otherwise should be. Here's the one. I've covered a lot of markets in my career. The price is the price. It's not right. It's not wrong. It is the price. It's objective. What a buyer is willing to buy and a seller is willing to sell. It's not correct or wrong. It is what it is. The question becomes, are we seeing either legitimate or illicit money fueling the velocity of prices in a direction at a speed that we otherwise wouldn't?
I think the issue is these units aren't being built for the domestic audience. The salaries here aren't going up like crazy like this. The most of the new jobs that are being added are in the lower wage and middle wage sector. They're not high paying jobs. So when you see, you know, asking $725 per square foot, that's not for us. That's not because there's not a lot of unsold units on the market. Mm-hmm. That's because foreign investors, some legitimate, some not, are coming in. And then the question is, what happens with these units later? Will they be able to resell them? Remember, interest rates are going up, so it'll be hard. The domestic buyer will have less buying power in 3 years than they have today.
The domestic buyer who's borrowing money, we should add. That's where interest rates come into play. This is the Florida Roundup here, talking about Florida real estate and what role the possibility of money laundering is playing with real estate prices we've seen. Robert joins us from Homestead here on the Florida Roundup. Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. Basically, I've been looking for a house, putting in a bunch of appraisals, and to my shock, I lost three different bids. One was $40,000 above appraisal in cash. Another one, $60,000 above appraisal. Another one, $20,000. It's absolutely obvious. And you know, I live in a rental.
Robert, hold on. What is it that's obvious?
Well, I mean, the realtors, the sellers, they get people coming in. They take cash from South America. Who's going to pay $40,000 above appraisal? Why would you do that?
Robert joining us from Homestead there. Good luck on your real estate search. And Billy, he voices what I think a lot of potential home buyers are experiencing, and that is getting outbid, possibly fueled by illicit money, but also fueled by the lack of inventory here. And let's face it, there's plenty of foreigners that would rather live here in the 51st state.
Well, you're right in that something is only worth what somebody else is willing to pay for it, whether that's high or low. But the reality is, I think you're seeing an artificially inflated market, which is ultimately good for no one. And listen, I come from a generation of renters. It's highly likely that I'm never going to own a house. I mean, that's just the reality. It's impractical. I mean, even with mortgage rates as low as they can go, I don't know that moving forward I'd ever be able to afford to do that. And that, unfortunately, is the reality of America now. I mean, you have sort of the collapse of the American dream, and that this generation is not going to have a better life or do better than the one before it. And in no small part, you're seeing that disparity on third worldian levels occurring here in South Florida.
Billy Corbin is with us. He is with Raconteur Films. We've got Brian Bandel from South Florida Business Journal with the great cover piece that hits the streets today, Cash, Condos, and Criminals, talking about money laundering and the fueling of condominium prices here in South Florida. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson on WLRN. Your show, too. Give us a call, 800-743-WLRN, on Twitter at WLRN and at WLRN.org. Still to come, convicted sexual predators released after doing their time in Florida attack again. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
I will never see my mother again. She's gone. So what am I going to do? And my kids, it just tore them apart.
I'm going to be in pain for the rest of my life.
The Sun Sentinel found 594 sex offenders convicted in a new sex offense after being considered under the law and let go.
That's from a Sun Sentinel newspaper video report accompanying a lengthy investigative report examining repeated convicted sex offenders in Florida. And what the report concludes is quite alarming. The failure, quote, at every level, end quote, of the Jimmy Rice Law. The two reporters behind this extraordinary piece of investigative journalism, Sally Creston with the Sun Sentinel and Dana Williams, joins us now here on the Florida Roundup. First of all, great work, both of you. Thank you for the work. Sally, what is the Jimmy Rice Law?
The Jimmy Rice Law was named after the 9-year-old boy who was abducted, raped, and murdered in Miami-Dade back in 95. His parents, Don and Claudine Rice, lobbied for a law. They wanted to see some good come from that just horrific tragedy. So the law, it's called civil commitment, and it allows the state to review all sex offenders who are in prison and are about to be released to identify the ones who are considered sex predators and are likely to reoffend. They then can be held past their prison sentences and civilly committed indefinitely until a judge allows their release and finds that they're no longer dangerous.
And this can happen against their will.
It's considered involuntary commitment, correct.
Dana, what's the agency responsible for carrying it out, and how is the process supposed to work?
The Department of Children and Families carries out the law. They actually screen sex offenders, anybody with a prior sex offense, before they get out of prison, and they determine if the person should be evaluated further. If the person is evaluated further, they go to a multidisciplinary team. That team can meet with the offender, reviews all the background of the offender, and makes a recommendation whether the state should seek commitment. In that case, if they do seek commitment, they send a letter to the state attorney in the county where the crime was committed, and then that attorney, the state attorney, will file a petition for commitment or not.
Your investigation found failure at every level, is the way that you described it. Where particularly is the significant weaknesses?
It starts with really at every step. The first step is the screening by the Department of Children and Families, and we found that they apply a pretty narrow definition of who is considered a predator. The law requires someone to have at least one conviction for a sexually violent offense and a mental disorder that makes them likely to reoffend. The department looks for rapists with multiple violent offenses, child molesters with multiple victims. So part of I think one of the issues is they're missing people in that initial screening. And then the psychology behind trying to evaluate these sex offenders, they're not truthful. It's just inexact. So when they make it to the next level, a psychological evaluation, that sometimes they miss people there. And then even when they try to commit someone, the state considers a sex predator, they're released. Half of them are released by the courts. Either the prosecutors don't file petitions or they go to trial and a judge or a jury just is unwilling to civilly commit them and they're let go.
Sally Creston is with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Dana Williams with the same newspaper, both of them partnering on an extensive investigation looking into repeat convicted sex offenders in Florida. Sally, tell us the story of Donald Stevens. This is one of those that you highlighted in your reporting as an example of how the Jimmy Rice Law has failed at, quote, every level.
Yes, Mr. Stevens had an extensive history, criminal history, and had been identified as a sex predator, went through the civil commitment process, and ended up at the Civil Commitment Center, at the Sex Predator Treatment Center in Arcadia. And he was there for a number of years, and then was determined they're allowed to come up for a review annually. And he did, and he was found to no longer meet the criteria, that's the term they use, to remain confined. And he was released, and just a few months later, I believe it was three, kidnapped a woman and committed a very violent offense.
The investigation by the Sun Sentinel into the Jimmy Rice Law, the application of it, has garnered plenty of attention, not only within the state of Florida, but also nationwide. Jean Baker is with the Miami chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. She joins us on the line here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Jean, what's your take on what the Sun Sentinel investigation uncovered and the conclusions it drew?
Thank you for taking my call. I want to say this. We appreciate the tragedy of the 14 deaths that are identified, and we really feel terrible for the families that suffer. But we have to look at the overall picture, and this is what the Sun Sentinel article fails to do. There have been 31,000 offenders screened for Jimmy Rice processing over 14 years. 31,000. The 14 tragic deaths come to a percentage of 0.05%, a fraction less than 1% of the 31,000. Ms. Keston has identified 594 sex offenders who she said were reconvicted of another crime after they were Jimmy Rice processed. 594 out of 31,000 is 1.9%. This means more than 98% of the Jimmy Rice processed people, the call was made correctly.
All right.
In 98%. Now, study is needed, and Ms. Keston calls for study at the end of her article, which we totally applaud. There's an organization attached to the legislature called the Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability. OPAGA should be asked, look into the efficacy of the Jimmy Rice Law, of the sex registry laws, which we also don't think are effective. We do need study, but premature legislation, increasing mandatory sentences or imposing mandatory sentences, would not even deal with whether or not the Jimmy Rice statute is acting properly.
That's Jean Baker
really
with the Miami chapter of the American
down.
Civil Liberties
Thank
Union.
You.
Jean, we want to let Sally and Dana respond to the constructive criticism. Is it a matter of 14 cases out of several dozen thousands that you've identified in the research and the investigative piece, Sally?
The 14 cases refers to there were 14 murders committed by folks who were screened under this law. There were about 1,400 who were rearrested on sex offenses, 594 who have been convicted of sex offenses. Our intent was never to do a recidivism study, but to simply look at cases where the law had missed people and to see if it was working as intended. We have another story coming up where we interviewed Don Rice, Jimmy's father, and the sponsors of the bill, and their conclusion is, no, it hasn't worked as they intended it.
Sally Creston with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Dana Williams along with us, also from the newspaper, talking about their investigative work in regards to the Jimmy Rice Law and repeat convicted sex offenders. Dana, this has garnered some attention of state legislators that have promised at least some action on it come early March. Do we know the type of action that is planned on being taken at this point, Dana or Sally?
I think Sally would be better to answer that.
They're looking at a couple of different things, I think, on the front end, perhaps maybe imposing some minimum mandatory sentences for more sex crimes so that people are locked up longer, essentially. And then on the back end, shoring up the Jimmy Rice law so that maybe fewer people slip through who truly are dangerous.
This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Join the conversation at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Also on Twitter at WLRN and at WLRN.org. As we mentioned, some of the debate that this investigative piece has sprung out is a conversation on the legislative side as well as in communities about the sentencing of convicted sex offenders. Manuel joins us from Jeansburg, New Jersey. He had been from Florida. And Manuel, I take it you are a convicted sex offender here in the Sunshine State.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yes, I am a convicted sex offender in the Sunshine State there. I've actually moved away about 10 years ago and have not been able to return. And the increasing ordinances that keep on getting passed county by county and city by city make it more and more difficult for someone like myself to find housing. I don't know exactly where I fall into the category of sex offenders or anything like that, but as far as myself, I have 3 children of my own. I have a home. I have a wife. I have as much of a normal life as I can maintain.
Well, Manuel, to be fair, if you're labeled a sex offender, I'm guessing, I don't know any particulars of your case. I don't know if you ladies do either, but I'm guessing at some point there was a conviction of a sex-related crime in the state of Florida.
Yes, sir, there was. I was actually convicted of a sex crime in Florida. My victim was 14 and I was 21 at the time. And I've paid back my debt to society as far as Florida wanted me to do. I did all my probation. I did all my everything that was required of me. I did, but yet I still fall under the category of sex offender, which is fine by me. But I keep on getting punished in the sense that I can't even go back to my home state, where my mother's health is starting to fail. She's getting older. My father passed away in 2009, and I wasn't there when he passed away. And I'm missing out on my family. All of my family is down there.
Manuel joining us from Jeansburg, New Jersey, a convicted Florida sex offender, saying that he can no longer come back to his home state. And part of the conversation here that we've been having with this investigative series from the Sun Sentinel is regarding the severity of Florida sex crimes and the punishment and the lack of distinction in some cases here with the Florida law. Christine joins us from Jacksonville here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Christine, go ahead.
Well, I just think that Florida has the draconian laws putting nonviolent sex offenders, and I do know the guy that just spoke his case, it was a consensual sex, whether or not, you know, it's morally wrong. They cannot legislate morality. You cannot do it. We've been having sex since we were 12, 13 years old, many, many years ago. And Florida's just putting everybody, whether you urinate, whether you unknowingly download child porn when you're looking at pornography, whether you moon someone, whether you have consensual sex, someone that's 17 in college has sex with a 25-year-old, these are not violent crimes. These are not violent crimes, and they don't belong on the registry.
Christine in Jacksonville joining us here on the Florida Roundup, discussing the idea of the broad swath of Florida sex laws and that they don't make distinctions. Sally, as you heard from Manuel in New Jersey and Christine from Jacksonville, a lot of raised eyebrows I saw from you and your reaction that you're hearing from these callers that are saying there ought to be more complex or more distinct definitions of sexual crimes in Florida and those convicted of it, let alone the sexual predator definition that is at the heart of the Jimmy Rice laws.
Yeah, and I think the intent of the Jimmy Rice law and I think the intent of the legislature is to be able to distinguish between those sex offenders who are a true danger to society versus someone who may, you know, Romeo Juliet type of case. And I don't, from my conversations with legislators, I don't see them headed in that direction where they're, I think they are trying to target those violent sex crimes and stop the repeat offenders who really are dangerous.
Dana, out there, as you wandered through the investigative paperwork that really backs up the series in your reporting, is there a desire, is there a need for a more complex definition of different sex crimes in the state of Florida?
I think that's going to have to be something that the people of Florida decide. And the the legislators are looking at different things now. I think it's a good place to start is to have a conversation about it. But ultimately, the people of Florida have to decide what kind of laws they want to have, what kind of classifications they want to have, and I think it's good to have input from everybody on that.
Yeah, we've got more input here on WLRN here on the Florida Roundup. Shana joins us from New York as the executive director of a group that's certainly focused on the definitions of sex crime. Shana, give us an idea of your organization and how you see Florida's approach.
Hi, thanks for having me. As I think everybody on the call knows, Florida has some of the toughest sex offender laws in the entire nation, especially now that they became compliant with the Adam Walsh Act. And as we're all discussing here, there are many different types of sex offenders. And, you know, it's frustrating for me to hear things like the state of Florida needs to decide if they need distinctions between sex offenders, because the fact is that the state of Florida needs and deserves to be educated on what the empirical evidence says in the last two decades. And the evidence in the last two decades has indicated that, as a broad group, sex offenders have one of the lowest recidivism rates in the entire criminal justice system. They are almost always in the single digits, regardless of what media coverage typically says. It's been proved over and over and over again. The residency restrictions that Florida has enacted, and I mean, they continue making them tougher and tougher. And again, there's significant evidence that shows that residency restrictions don't work.
Shana joining us from USA Fair in New York, discussing the idea of Florida sex laws here. Sally Creston of the South Florida Sun Sentinel and Dana Williams along with us from the newspaper, discussing their investigative series on repeat convicted sex offenders. The comment was made that Florida sex laws are some of the harshest in the nation. Sally, is that an assessment you agree with?
I believe there have been, I recall seeing a study comparing different states, and yes, Florida does have a number of the types of restrictions through the laws that are considered tough. And, you know, to the point of recidivism from the previous caller, I think the distinction here is when you compare sex crimes to other crimes, these are, it's a little bit different in my view in terms of the nature of the violence and the harm that is inflicted in a sex crime, and it can stay, it can scar people for life, and I think there is a distinction certainly that legislators here are drawing between that and other types of crime. And you know, if it's a 10% recidivism rate or 15, as a recent study in Florida showed, I think that's the issue, is what is acceptable for these types of very violent invasive crimes.
What do we know about the state's capacity to deal and house and treat predators that are defined the way that the Jimmy Rice law is currently practiced?
There is one treatment center in Arcadia. It's called the Florida Civil Commitment Center, where if you are committed, that's where you go, or if you're recommended for commitment, you're held there. It's got a capacity of 720 beds. There was a time a few years ago when that was under construction, and the beds were filling up, and it was expected to be over capacity by the time it opened. We found that there was a decision made by the Department of Children and Families at that time to narrow the definition of predator, because the center was filling up, and it was a cost savings to the state. There is now some talk of expanding, maybe not expanding that particular facility, but converting some unused prison beds to expand the capacity, if the legislature does decide to move in a direction of applying a broader definition of predator and committing more sex offenders.
So we've heard from many different perspectives, and I do want to go back to Gene Baker from the American Civil Liberties Union on line six here, Paul, the Miami chapter, that had some criticism regarding the findings and the research. And Gene, I want to come back to the point here to end on this, that essentially your point was the size of the problem identified by the Sun Sentinel investigation is not large enough, and I'm putting words in your mouth, I realize, but not large enough. Or is a relative is minuscule compared to the success stories.
What I really want to emphasize is this: we need evidence-based research to figure out, first of all, what did go wrong in the cases that Sally Creston identified, but also to figure out whether the Jimmy Rice Law is working, and evidence-based research to figure out whether the whole registration scheme is working. There are new preliminary findings that the ACLU is aware of that have not yet been published, but that are going to be published fairly soon based on FDLE, that's Florida Department of Law Enforcement Agency, data that show that over the last 21 years, there has been no effective change in the recidivism rate of sex offense in Florida. As one of your earlier callers said quite correctly, sex offense has, over the nation and here in Florida, a very low recidivism rate. The question is, are our laws improving? Are our laws making the situation better? The question you asked at the beginning of the program was, does the sex registry make us safer? And that is a question that has to be answered by evidence-based studies.
Yeah.
The answer is it doesn't.
Gene,
and those findings will be coming out.
I never asked the question about whether or not the sex registry system in Florida makes us safer or not. But
it was on your website.
But on the website.
Right.
All right. WLRN.org. Thank you. Gene Baker with the ACLU Miami chapter. And, Sally and Dana, I think everybody would agree that, yes, evidence-based research is really what is necessary in order to make laws. The effective nature of your investigative piece is this dialogue has begun at neighborhood levels, at county levels, and at the state levels. And I suppose to you, Sally, is this, in your estimation, a fast reaction that is not based on evidence and evidence-based research? Or conversely, is there the evidence-based research that's going to come between now and March when the state legislature comes back into session to have a full-faith hearing regarding the Jimmy Rice laws?
I think there certainly is a public debate on this now, and that's great. That's healthy. I do expect the legislature to hold committee hearings and air out whatever bills that they propose. And I'm confident that they will proceed with evidence-based research at their disposal. So I think that's our intent was to point here's the issue with this particular law, and let the people who are in charge of setting policy decide what the best response is to that.
And hear from their constituents between now and March, as well beyond that as well. Sally Creston, South Florida Sun Sentinel. Dana Williams, South Florida Sun Sentinel, reporting on repeat convicted sex offenders here in the state of Florida, joining us on the Florida Roundup here. I'm Tom Hudson on WLRN. Stay close here. We've got more to come, including another week and another politician arrested. That's the South Florida Arts Beat with Ed Bell, a preview of this weekend's Coconut Grove Black Heritage Music Series coming up at 1 o'clock with Ed. Stay tuned here on WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Another week in South Florida politics and another elected official arrested. This time, the mayor of Homestead, Steve Bateman. Here's Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle.
It's another very sad day for the people of Miami-Dade County. Today, our office, with the assistance of the Ethics Commission, arrested Homestead Mayor Steve Bateman. He is being charged for a variety of crimes, including two felonies, for using his elected position as mayor of the city of Homestead to provide really himself with private income and private employment.
Our guests here on the Florida Roundup, Patty Massey, reporter for the Miami Herald. Patty, the official charge here against now former Mayor Bateman, what is it?
It's unlawful compensation. So what the state attorney's office says is that he secretly had this consulting deal where he represented a nonprofit healthcare agency as their lobbyist, but never disclosed to any Homestead official, certainly, but also to Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez or anybody else, that he was working on behalf of this company. He would just be the mayor of Homestead.
What's your sense of the evidence that that the state attorney compiled to get to the point this week where there was an arrest, a knock on the door and an arrest?
Well, we had reported, my colleagues at the Herald, Jay Weaver, Patricia Borns, had been reporting about this consulting deal. And the mayor was, in fact, fired from his gig recently, I think last week, shortly before his arrest. To me, what's really...
By the gig, you mean the consulting gig.
Correct.
Yeah.
What's really compelling here is the day of his arrest, the city of Homestead held a news conference, which is very unusual, where city commissioners and the city manager were basically saying, yes, we knew this was going on and we've reported him and it was terrible and we're really glad that this is moving forward. And That's so very rare to see a city just come out and instead of saying, well, you know, someone's innocent until proven guilty, just kind of piling on.
Right. And conversely, though, the day after his arrest, he's released and he winds up on the side of a road in Homestead holding campaign signs with supporters.
That's correct. The governor, Rick Scott, suspended Mayor Bateman from office the day of his arrest, but he was already seeking re-election, so he seems to be moving forward with his campaign as planned.
So what seems to be wrong here? Is it, are local officials, can they act as unpaid lobbyists? I mean, essentially, isn't a politician a lobbyist for his or her municipality?
Well, they would certainly not call themselves their lobbyist for their municipality. They would
not under the legal definition, certainly.
But even in public, you know, that word seems to have a bit of a taint. But no, they're not supposed to take on any financial, you know, gain privately and not disclose it. That's why elected officials have financial disclosures that they have to fill out. They have gift disclosures where they have to say if anybody has given them anything of over a certain value. And that's what the state attorney's office says Mayor Bateman didn't do here.
This is the third Miami-Dade mayor to be arrested in a month. We had the mayor of Miami Lakes and the Sweetwater mayor accused of accepting kickbacks earlier this month. Is this the Fed turning up the heat on some of these local officials? Are we hitting critical mass with some of these goings on?
Well, some of my colleagues were quick to point out that there are 35 mayors in Miami-Dade County. Three have been arrested in a month, so that's about 10%.
Yep.
I'm not sure if the heat is being turned up or it's just that we've had a bad rash of folks doing things and getting caught. The federal investigation was ongoing for a couple of years, so we really don't know what they have up their sleeves right now that we might be seeing, you know, in a year or 2 years from
right
now.
Right, right. Finally, we do have to talk a little bit more about some local politics in the city of Miami. The city commissioner, Francis Suarez, dropped out of the race for mayor this week, citing his wife's pregnancy and a series of campaign miscues. He made a quick impression in this race. Yes, he comes from a political family, but he had, almost $500,000 in private campaign contributions?
He made a lot of money very quickly in his campaign and in his political committee. And that is why people thought he was a serious contender against the incumbent mayor, Tomás Regalado. But he admitted that his campaign made some mistakes, perhaps errors of youth and inexperience from the folks that he brought on to work with him. And now he goes back to being a commissioner. The three people who had intended to file for his commission seat are kind of left out in the cold. The mayor, unless somebody files in the next month here with an ability to raise a lot of money very quickly and a high name recognition, is probably assured another four-year term.
Patty Mazzei with the Miami Herald covers local politics. To that last point, Patty, Miami is a city of about 500,000 people. It's a global city. Why don't we have a more competitive mayoral race?
That's a good question. It's a city that has more people in it every day for work than who actually live there.
Sure.
You know, when you say 500,000, I think people are saying, no, there's got to be more people in the city of Miami.
Those are residents.
Correct. The number of residents is relatively small. And there's little interest, unfortunately, is what we see a lot of the time, not just in the city of Miami, but across the municipalities and the county. We have local parties, but these are nonpartisan seats. So you know, if unless they're building a bench, it's just unlikely to have them. But that's a good question that I wish somebody would kind of study at on the academic level. You know, what draws people to these seats and what could be done to bring more candidates?
A story in the future for the Miami Herald. For Patricia Mazzei, thank you very much, Patty, joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Finally, 50 years ago this week, when hundreds of thousands of Americans gathered in Washington, D.C. on the National Mall. The nation was in the throes of a debate over racial civil rights. WLRN's Terrence Shepard, Alicia Zuckerman, with the help of Wilson Sayre, spoke with four South Floridians who were there 50 years ago to hear Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech ring out from the Lincoln Memorial.
We got off the bus. Oh my God! The crowds, the people from every direction.
You could tell there were a lot of people coming because there were extraordinary number of buses.
Thousands of buses.
We had to assemble at the Washington Monument and then move on to the Lincoln Memorial.
And then I started to see the signs. I was carrying a sign that says, no more segregation.
The union people had plenty of signs. UAW.
Equal pay.
From the AFL-CIO.
Women's rights.
The NAACP.
Voting rights. There were white people. There were black. I had never seen such different colors in my whole life in one place. All of those people on my side. Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? Don't look at Uncle Charlie.
There was a whole program that lasted, I guess, from 10 or 11 until about 3 or 4. Speeches, entertainment.
Mahalia Jackson.
John Lewis was there.
And then here comes Dr. King.
Dr. King, on the stage, first of all, he looked taller than he was. I don't know whether he was standing on a little stool or what.
Doc was a very unpromising photo subject. And I know that sounds hilarious, and it's not meant with any disrespect, but he was a short man. He was only 5'5", and he had a rotund face.
Well, to me, he was a handsome guy. Very, very good-looking man.
He looked sad up there. When he started off his speech, I wasn't impressed. I thought Whitney Young had the better speech.
And even the very beginning of his speech, I had not paid too much attention.
Initially, he was reading the speech, and at some point, he put down the speech and spoke extemporaneously.
We will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
He began to speak in cadences. He began to speak like a country preacher. He began to sing, in other words. He seemed to have transformed himself by his own words.
But when he said, I have a dream.
One day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice.
So he was talking about my state. So as he began to speak of his dream, I sat down because it was so electric.
Will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin.
His dream statement's a wonderful statement, but his emphasis was on the work to get to that goal, not on the goal.
And at the end of the oration, he lifts up his right hand and stretches it out as far as he can and calls out in the old slave chant, free at last, free at last.
Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
That is what I caught with my camera, and I guess in some sort of oratorical ecstasy. this was too big and too powerful to stop. The train had left the station and
Hope was alive.
You can hear the entire report of four South Floridians remembering this week 50 years ago. Just head to WLRN.org. That is the Florida Roundup here this week on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The program produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow. Our executive producer for WLRN, Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor today, Paul Leary. Be sure to stay tuned for the South Florida Arts Beat with Ed Bell, including that preview of this weekend's Coconut Grove Black Heritage Music Series. Monday morning at 9 on the Sunshine Economy, it is tourism, Labor Day, the official, unofficial end of summer. We'll take a look at tourism here in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.